Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In a recent New York Times piece about disappearing honeybees, Bill Dale, the owner of Big Sky Honey in Fairview, Montana, said that his bees looked so healthy last spring. Quote, "We were so proud of them. And then about the 1st of September, they started to fall on their face to die like crazy. We've been doing this for 30 years, and we've never experienced this kind of loss before." End quote. Beekeepers and researchers say honeybees started disappearing back in 2006, and since then, it's gotten progressively worse. Brett Addy, the owner of Addy Honey Farms in South Dakota, the nation's largest beekeeper, told the New York Times, quote, "We lost 42% over the winter, but by the time we came around to pollinate almonds, it was a 55% loss." Now, beekeepers and researchers say pesticides are partly to blame. A recent USDA study made a link between the insecticides, which are used to ward off things like aphids and beetles, and honeybee deaths. Last week, in an unprecedented move, the European Union voted to place a 2-year moratorium on a class of pesticides called neonicotinoids. They're thought to be harming the global bee population, but these chemicals are still being widely used here in the U.S. 4 beekeepers and 5 environmental groups recently filed a lawsuit in federal district court against the EPA for its failure to protect pollinators from dangerous pesticides. So why should we care about this? Well, bees are an integral part of our food and ecosystem. So many of the fruits and vegetables we eat depend on pollination by honeybees. The UN Food and Agriculture Organization estimates that out of 100 crop species, which provide 90% of food worldwide, 71 of these are bee pollinated. But their rapid decline has caused major concern. So on today's Your Call, we are talking about why the bees are dying and, most importantly, what will it take to save them? Today, we're joined by Paul Towers, organizing and media director at the Pesticide Action Network, and they're one of the environmental groups that has sued the EPA. Hi, Paul. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Scott Black, executive director of the Xerxes Society, an international nonprofit dedicated to protecting the diversity of life through the conservation of invertebrates. And he joins us. Hi, Scott. Where are you located?
I'm in Portland, Oregon.
Portland.
Today.
Hi. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And we're joined by Marianne Fraser, senior extension associate at Penn State, where she works in the Department of Entomology on understanding how pesticides impact honeybees. Hi, Marianne. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Rose. Nice to be with you.
It's great to have you. So, Marianne, I want to start off with you. Do you think that people understand the scope of this problem? Because we've been reading about bees for the last 3 days, and I'm drinking this green smoothie that's full of vegetables. And if it weren't for bees, this smoothie wouldn't exist.
You know, oddly enough, the thing that has somewhat changed that scenario is this whole collapse of honeybees. And the amount of press that it's gotten over the last couple of years has created an awareness in the population about the importance of bees and people being concerned about the loss of bees. So I have to say, in general, you're right. There is a lack of understanding, but one of the silver linings in this disaster has been that we do have somewhat more public awareness, and we have a lot of people, surprisingly enough, becoming beekeepers. This has been another ramification, is that lots and lots of people who have maybe thought about beekeeping or never thought about it but heard about the collapse want to do something about it, so they become beekeepers. So We've seen a huge increase in the number of small hobby beekeepers over the past couple of years.
And Paul, what would you add to that when you look at the scope of this issue?
Well, I think that's right. A lot of people don't still understand the impact of pollination on our entire food system. So we've heard this statistic before, but 1 in 3 bites of food we eat rests on bees. And I think about my time at the Kensington Farmers Market this weekend in the Bay Area, and you know, the cherries there that I was purchasing rely on bees for pollination. The honey, of course, that I was buying there also rests on bees. And then some of the almonds that I was able to still buy there also rest on bees. So many of these things that I think we take for granted in California and across the country really rely on bees to perform those daily tasks to keep eating the things we enjoy.
So we owe bees a huge thanks, really, for all of the food that we eat. Scott, how big is this problem? Because when you say that 40 to 50% of hives have disappeared, it's kind of hard to imagine what that means exactly.
It is hard to imagine what that means, but think of it in any other business. Can you imagine you produce shirts and you lose 40% of your product every year? Can you imagine if you were in a cattle operation and every year you lost 40% of your cows? You know, this is very, very difficult for beekeepers, and very difficult if you're really trying to make a business out of beekeeping and producing honey as well as providing a pollination service. So it's huge.
So, Marianne, Paul's just said that one in three bites of our food rests on bees. So why don't you explain the pollination process?
So for many things like grasses, grass-type products, like corn, wheat, rice, these things are wind-pollinated. They don't require insects or other kinds of organisms other than wind to pollinate them, and so they're able to reproduce and produce grain and so forth without the aid of insects. But things that provide a lot of the micronutrients that we depend on, like the fruits and vegetables that we just heard about, apples, cranberries, strawberries, pumpkins, seeds for things like onions, for instance. These things are pollinated by insects, so they need an insect. Typically, there are some other agents of pollination, but insects in general and bees specifically, bees are really built for pollination because bees require pollen to rear their young. So they have a mutualistic relationship with plants. So the bees visit the flowers and they transport pollen from the male parts of the flower to the female parts of the flower, which then allow fertilization to take place, and that allows the plant to actually produce the fruit and the seeds to, make sure that we have the next generation of plants. But in so doing, they also provide the food that we eat, those fruits and vegetables. So that's why bees are so critical, because they are the ones that really have this unique relationship on a large scale with so many different kinds of plants. And we can manipulate them. A lot of these other kinds of insects are and pollinators, but we can't manipulate them like we can bees. But in other words, we can't take them to a crop where they're needed when they're needed in order to pollinate the crop.
It's amazing to think that there are 4,000 types of bees, but not all of them pollinate.
Well, yes, there are 4,000 types of bees in North America, and many of them do pollinate, but they don't necessarily, most of them, I would say, probably are responsible for pollinating something, but not necessarily our food crops. The ecosystem, of course, needs a fair amount of pollination as well, so maybe not plants that we depend on for food, but maybe birds and or other animals are depending on, and the health of an ecosystem, for instance, depends on that diversity of plants. So other bees, and many of these other bees are even involved in crop pollination. It's just that when we have a large crop like almonds, for instance, that don't have a large native bee population, it does require the introduction of pollinators, and in this case it would be honeybees, on a large scale to get the job done.
So so many of the articles and the studies say that the die-off began in 2005. Is that right?
So, it's a little bit hard to put our finger on. The first person who actually identified what we now know as CCD was Dave Hackenberg, and that was late 2006. But we think that there were other incidents of this prior to 2006, and it just wasn't reported.
Okay, so before we talk about why this is happening, let's talk about some of the studies. Has this been researched adequately? Has there been a lot of data looking at why this is happening?
So asking me, Marianne, yes, there has been a fair amount of research done, an amazing amount of research in the last few years, but it is a very complex, what we have found is that it is a very complex situation, and there are many factors that we think are at play here, are at work, and we do not have the complete picture by any means. So the research has been significant, but probably has not been adequate to get at what's happening not only with honeybees, but with bird species, with frogs, with bats, etc.
Scott, what are your thoughts on that, and why haven't we seen more research?
Well, I think there is a lot of research, and I think although the issue with honeybees is complex, and we've got disease, we've got potentially lack of floral resources, we've got mites, and we've got pesticides in here, I think that we do know that this new class of pesticides called neonicotinoids is one factor in CCD. And I think that also we know that honeybees are kind of like the canary in the coal mine. And this, as Marianne alluded to, goes much, much farther than just the honeybee story. We have, as you mentioned, 4,000 other species of bees in the United States. An article in Science has shown that they are really important in crop pollination for certain crops, but they also pollinate about 90% of all of the plant species on Earth, that bees and other pollinators. And that's huge. Plants are the base of all of our food webs. And we have study after study that comes out that shows that imidacloprid and clothianidin and thiamethoxam, these are three of the main neonicotinoids, are highly toxic to honeybees, as well as bumblebees and other native pollinators. And we do know that they're in the environment. They're found in water throughout the United States by the USGS at this point. We know that they're widely, widely used in both agriculture as well as in urban areas. One thing I'd like to point out, Rose, a lot of people think about ag as using lots of pesticides, but in many urban areas, we use more pesticides per acre than we do in ag. So we need to be thinking about both sides of this. So I think we do have evidence that these chemicals, both for pollinators, for other beneficial insects, a new study out of the Netherlands showing decline in aquatic insects, that these chemicals are having a major effect on ecosystems across the world.
And your organization, the Xerxes Society, actually put out a study on these neonicotinoids.
Yes, we did a review back in 2012. That looked at all of the studies, and we sort of rated them on how much we knew about the facts of these studies, and what we knew as facts, what we could suspect based on what we knew, and then of course there is, as Marianne pointed out, a lot of information we don't know. But in that review, we do know that this class of chemical is highly toxic to honeybees and other pollinators. We do know that they're really long-lived in the environment. They can be active in soil for months, if not years. They can be in woody tissue of plants for years, maybe up to 6 years. They are presented in pollen and nectar, where bees and other pollinators can get to these chemicals. So I think we have good evidence that that these chemicals are one of the reasons for decline in honeybees, but also potential decline in other pollinators and other beneficial insects.
And who actually uses these neonicotinoids?
Well, they're used broadly for everything from this is what you put on your cat as a flea treatment.
Oh, wow.
They're used in termite control in houses. They're used as a seed coat, one of the biggest uses as a seed coat in corn. So they put it right on the seed, and it's the chemical, the insecticide is basically with the plant the entire life of that plant. And that's the other thing, is that these are what we call systemic insecticides. And so once you treat a plant, they're in that inside the plant rather than sprayed, just on the plant and then have a, go away as rain and weather, go over these crops. These chemicals are inside the plant, and they're used everywhere, these in almost everything, and soon to be approved for use in rice in California.
For rice?
For rice in California, and rice is not an insect-pollinated crop, but rice is very important for birds feeding in the rice. These areas, the water is drained into the Sacramento River or the San Joaquin River, depending on where these rice fields are. And we've got good data coming out of the Netherlands that these chemicals cause a major impact on aquatic systems.
Mm.
So I have big concerns and think that EPA should really take action and take action soon.
And Mother Jones had a long piece about this. They report that here in the U.S., neonic-treated crops cover a landmass equivalent to as much as twice the size of California. So that is massive when you think about how much these pesticides are used. That is Scott Black. He's executive director of the Xerxes Society, an international nonprofit dedicated to protecting the diversity of life through conservation. Marianne Fraser, senior extension associate at Penn State, where she works in the Department of Entomology to understand how pesticides are affecting honeybees. And Paul Towers is organizing and media director at the Pesticide Action Network. They are one of a handful of environmental organizations that are suing the EPA along with beekeepers over these bee toxic pesticides. And on today's Your Call, we are talking about the sad disappearance of honeybees. It started in 2005, 2006. Beekeepers say it's getting progressively worse. Brett Addy, the owner of Addy Honey Farms in South Dakota, the nation's largest beekeeper, said that he lost 42% over the winter, and by the time they came around to pollinate almonds, it was a 55% loss. So what are your thoughts on this? What questions do you have about the disappearance of honeybees? If you are a beekeeper or if you work with fruits and vegetables, we'd love to hear from you. What kinds of changes have you seen over the years? What concerns you? And then most importantly, how can we save the bees? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. This got a lot of attention last week. The European Union voted to place a two-year moratorium on these neonicotinoids. And first of all, before we talk about what's happening in the U.S., Paul, talk about the significance of the EU taking this action.
Well, certainly. The EU decision is the result of many years at this point of intense pressure from local governments and environmental groups, beekeepers all across the region. For some time, folks, beekeepers in particular across Europe, noticed some of the links in some of the early declines in bees and started, based on the scientific evidence coming forward, started putting two and two together and suggested that they should be restricting the use of some of these neonicotinoid pesticides. That culminated in a decision last week in a continent-wide restriction on the use of these three primary neonicotinoids that Scott mentioned earlier. This is imidacloprid, thiamethoxam, and clothianidin. And so for the next 2 years, there will be significant restrictions on the use of those products on key crops and anywhere that bees might be interacting with them.
They were under intense pressure in the EU not to do this by the pesticide industry.
Yeah, that's right. The two primary manufacturers, Syngenta and Bayer, so this is Bayer, the same company some of us might be familiar with a big headquarters in Emeryville, they are the two main manufacturers of these pesticides and seed treatments that are used on many of the commodity crops throughout the United States. And they have really launched an all-out offensive in that country and here as well, or in that region, in this country as well, to try and stop federal and international regulators from adding more and more restrictions to use of these products. So this is, you know, both lobbying behind the scenes in Brussels and in each individual country, and then this is in, you know, all-out offensive and the PR front, talk shows and paid advertisements, all in efforts to try and stop any of these governments from taking necessary steps to protect pollinators like honeybees.
And so the EU imposed a 2-year moratorium?
That's right. So for the next 2 years, actually starting in December of this year, there will be restrictions on the use of these main three products, the most widely used. And so it will be a bit of an opportunity to see what can take place. Again, we don't believe that that the reduction in these pesticides alone will dramatically, you know, be the silver bullet to save bees. They're part of the equation, but they're a really important one, and they're one that they can control and we can control in this country. So we're really hopeful that that will provide the space and the opportunity for pollinators in that country to recover.
And Marianne, what are your thoughts on that? How significant is this EU decision?
I think it's very significant, and I am certain that neonicotinoids are a problem for pollinators and for other organisms as well. I am, however, concerned that they're not, in even considering pesticides, that they are not the only problem. We have done quite a significant survey over the last 6 years of honeybees and wax and pollen, and we see a lot of pesticide in hives. Thankfully, not in honey. Very, very little in honey, due to the fact that most of these pesticides are lipophilic, meaning they want to dissolve in a fat, which wax and pollen are, and not a water-based substance of what, you know, like honey is. But we see on average 6 pesticides per pollen sample per colony, and as many as 32. And in fact, we see very little neonicotinoid, which is very surprising to us. And it may be that there are things happening, like, for instance, they may metabolize very quickly, and so we don't see them in our screen, but they are still present and having impacts. Nevertheless, we are very concerned about these other pesticides that we're seeing very widely, almost all the insecticide classes, insecticides, fungicides, herbicides. Bees, it turns out, are very good at picking up what's in their environment. And these things are accumulating in the hives and are present in combination. And just like a doctor asks you when you go and are being prescribed a new medication, you know, what other medications you're on because they're concerned about interactions, we are very concerned about the interactions of pesticides in the food that these bees are eating, in the wax where they're raising their brood, their young, their developing larvae. So our concerns about pesticides, we are concerned about neonicotinoids, but our concerns about pesticides go far beyond neonicotinoids.
And we're going to go to break just quickly, but between 6 and 32 pesticides, you know, some scientists say that, okay, those are high numbers, but we shouldn't be that concerned. I mean, how concerned are you when you find between 6 and 32 pesticides?
Very, very concerned. Very, very concerned. For the reasons I just mentioned, you know, the interactions, the potential for interactions, some pesticides can make others biologically more active. They can synergize. So while some things by themselves might not be that toxic, when they're present in combination, they're very toxic.
All right. And after the break, I'd love to ask you what this means for the bees and then what this means for those of us who consume this food. I mean, we're talking about everything from celery, cherries, apples, strawberries, almost, you know, so much, many of the fruits and vegetables we eat. 1 in 3 bites of our food rests on bees. We can thank bees for that. And today we're talking about the disappearance of bees. We're talking about 40 to 50% of hives since 2005. What questions do you have, and what do we need to do to save the bees? It's your call. We'll be back after this.
This is your call on KALW San Francisco. To join in today's conversation with Rose and her guests, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. If you prefer to write rather than call, the email inbox address is feedback@yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on tomorrow's show, we'll have a conversation about California Governor Jerry Brown's plan to overhaul the state's school funding system. He wants to redirect, or he's going to redirect, more money to schools with low-income and English-learning students. He says this is a civil rights cause for the children of California. So how will this work? What does this mean? And do you think this is the best way for the state to help economically disadvantaged school districts? On Tuesday, we'll have a conversation about breast cancer. Thursday, we'll have a debate about geoengineering. And Friday, we'll have a conversation with Jeremy Scahill about his new book, Dirty Wars. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the disappearance of honeybees. This started in 2005, 2006. Since then, it's gotten progressively worse. Beekeepers say between 40 to 50% of honeybees have been lost. And this is a huge deal when you think about the fact that one in three bites of food we eat rests on bees. They pollinate so many of the fruits and the vegetables that we eat. So why is this happening? Researchers point to things like poor nutrition and pesticides. And what will it take to save the bees? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255 if you're a beekeeper or if you work in with fruits and vegetables in the Central Valley, for example. What have you seen? What changes have you seen? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. We're joined today by Marianne Frazier, Senior Extension Associate at Penn State, where she works in the Department of Entomology on understanding how pesticides are impacting honeybees. Scott Black is Executive Director of the Xerxes Society, an international nonprofit dedicated to protecting the diversity of life through conservation. Paul Towers is organizing and media director of the Pesticide Action Network. They recently filed a lawsuit along with four other environmental groups and four beekeepers for its failure to protect pollinators from dangerous pesticides. And let's hear from callers on this. Let's go to Sean in San Francisco. Hi, Sean. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Rose. Hi. Hey, my question may have been answered earlier in the show. I didn't catch the beginning, but I had been reading and about speculation about the huge monocultures not providing enough vitamins and minerals and protein in the pollen for the bees. So I was just wondering about the issue of poor nutrition in colony collapse. So
yes.
You may have addressed that earlier.
No, thank you. We haven't addressed that yet. Thank you. We'll get to that in just a minute. But first, let's go to Alec in Oakland. Hi, Alec. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. We have a small farm, 12 acres, and last year we had two hives. They died. And a local bee guild, everybody's bees died. I think this is really a problem of big agriculture. Hmm. And in the sense that, well, they talk about manipulating the bees so they can take them to these huge almond farms.
Right.
It's all, you know, they don't get the nutrition like the previous lady said. And all these pesticides, all those big ag uses all those pesticides and herbicides and everything else that kill the bees.
And
so small people like us that don't do any of that, our bees range 2 to 3 miles, so they're picking it up anyway.
Sean, did this happen right away, or was it a progressive die-off?
Like you said, that the man up in Montana, how the bees looked great up until the fall.
Yeah.
Ours looked great. And then over the winter, both eyes died.
And so, I'm sorry, Alec. So what changed? What changes did you see?
Nothing. They just started to fall over, like you said.
Wow.
And my wife, you know, I was cleaning them and doing all she needed to do. We got two more hives, so we're going to try again. But what we're trying to do, we're also trying to create habitat for the native bees to see if we can get native bees for pollination. Because if you can't just, we got, I think, 2.5 quarts of honey last year. So that's basically about $300 for 2.5 quarts of honey. And we really didn't get pollination because they died, so. Mm-hmm. You know, you just can't keep doing that every year.
Right. Well, thank you for calling, Alex. Scott Black, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I don't know why in particular his beehives died. But one thing we do need to remember is that, and I think Marianne mentioned this, there are all sorts of pesticides in the environment. And this caller mentioned large ag. And those pesticides really do go hand in hand with the industrialization of agriculture. Back in the 40s and 50s, crop sizes got large. Monocultures were a new thing, really, in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. With them came the need both for moving pollinators to pollinate those crops, because there wasn't habitat around, there weren't feral honeybees, there were not the native bees necessary, and it was the advent of large-scale pesticides. And so we see this slew of pesticides in the environment, as Marianne has said. We have lack of floral resources in many places because of a variety of issues, everything from invasive species and GMO crops, where they can spray out the weeds in between rows and next to roads. In the 60s in California, farmers were told to take out habitat because the habitat was what harbored quote-unquote pests. So lack of floral resources and habitat, we're seeing lots of pesticides. And so there is a really this synergistic effect. And then you've got the diseases within the hives and the mites, which Marianne could speak to much better than I could. But with all of these putting pressure on these hives, then you have collapse. That said, with the neonicotinoids, I believe because of their long half-life in the environment, that from a pollinator perspective, or at least from an ecosystem perspective, we could see even worse than some of the older classes. These older classes are much more toxic in some cases, especially to mammals, even to birds. But in the case of insects, the systemics are found in the soil, they last in the soil, they last in the plants, and they're systemic so that they are in the pollen and nectar. So this is a potentially huge problem. That said, these other factors all come into play, and these other insecticides are part of the issue.
Right, and we'll talk about poor nutrition in a minute. But since you spent so much time on pesticides, what changes specifically on pesticides would you like to see?
Well, I think the whole system is broken. You know, I've been working on conservation issues for a number of years, everything from salmon and spotted owl to pollinators. And pesticides is one of the most difficult issues to get at, and that is because the system is set up to fast-track new pesticides into the market without proper data to tell us whether they're going to have a large environmental impact or an impact on humans. And the system is really set up for the benefit of these chemical companies. And I don't say that lightly. I'm not part of the Paul's lawsuit and the folks' lawsuit, although I agree with it. We're not a litigious organization. We try to bring out facts about the science to a broader community. But really, this is an issue. We get these chemicals on the market. We haven't had enough study. Then we find out that they're problematic, and then it takes years for us to potentially get them off the market. And really, that needs to change. Mm.
Well, and Paul, talk a little bit about your lawsuit and what studies have the EPA conducted on these pesticides?
Well, yeah, it's a really good question. I think to note on the larger problem of industrial agriculture, we should note that the six largest pesticide companies also happen to be the six largest seed companies in the world right now, and are manufacturing many of these products that end up in our nation's agricultural fields. On the problem with, you know, the system is broken, it's very much the reason we've brought this suit. We hope to really force the issue to a head, the fact that EPA rests on data and information from pesticide manufacturers in order to allow these products on the market. And in many cases, because sufficient studies weren't done, the agency then declared that there were no adverse environmental impacts and then helped bring them to market even more quickly. And so it's like many other pesticides. We learn years later about the actual impacts of them. You know, it took us some years and enough research to understand that these neonicotinoids are posing serious threats to bees and increasingly birds and aquatic organisms. And, you know, this is part of that flawed registration system. We need to take a more precautionary approach, which would ensure that we have enough information, enough data in hand before we might allow these products onto the market. And, you know, California is starting to consider a little bit more of that direction. The federal government should do the same. But in the interim, these products should be taken off the market. And that's, you know, part of what our lawsuit with the Center for Food Safety and a group of beekeepers suggests is we need to take these products off the market. We need to finish doing the research. And we can't wait another decade for it to be done, which is what the Environmental Protection Agency and Department of Agriculture are suggesting is let's wait until 2018 or let's wait some number of years for action. We just can't afford to wait that long. So what we're saying is add restrictions, protect bees, change the labels or the way that pesticides are regulated, and ensure that there are protections in place for bees until then. Let's not fast-track these products on the market. Let's make sure we fix that system.
And that is Paul Towers, organizing and media director at the Pesticide Action Network. They are suing the EPA over these pesticides. The Huffington Post recently ran a piece about lobbying, and they found that Crop Life America, which is the trade association representing more than 90 of the world's biggest agrochemical manufacturers, has poured $11 million into lobbyists since 2008. And $643,000 into a PAC that backs congressional candidates sympathetic to the chemicals industry. The current chair of CropLife America is John Kroshniak. He's a pesticide specialist at DuPont, and the former chair, Bill Bucknell, was a senior exec at Bayer. So can you talk a little bit about this, Marianne? Do you expect the U.S. government to take action on these pesticides at a time when they're spending millions of dollars to lobby against it?
I agree with both of the previous Scott and Paul that the system is broken and that it needs to be addressed and that there are some simple steps that can be taken pretty quickly. Whether or not they will be taken is I have my concerns. I have my doubts based on past performance, I guess. One of the points I would like to make, an additional point, is that I don't think consumers realize in part that they also play a role in this. We have gotten to the point where we get every kind of food we want when we want it, and it's typically perfect, you know, mm-hmm. without insect damage, without any pathogen damage. And it's because growers are using pesticides the way they're using them. And so essentially when consumers buy all this fruit, these fruits and vegetables that are perfect and require that from the grocery stores, they are basically sending a message to the grocery stores and the growers that this is what we want. You know, we are going to reject fruit that has any kind of damage or vegetables that have any kind of insect damage or pathogen damage. We're not going to buy those things. So inadvertently, we are also responsible in part for this use of, you know, of a massive use of pesticides. And until we get over that, until we get over the need to have every ear of corn without a single worm in it, you know, earworm or
a
blemish
bruised
on an apple.
Yeah, right.
You know, this is part of what's driving that system that I don't think we often consider. So having a relationship with local farmers, you know, buying local produce, being willing to take fruits and vegetables that have some damage and cut that worm out is, I think, a part of the answer to this problem.
I went to my local grocery store, I don't know, about a month ago, and I saw grapes. It was kind of shocking to see grapes. And I said, why are you carrying grapes? And they said, because people demand it. And this mm-hmm. this is a tiny corner store mm-hmm. that sells mostly organic fruits. Mm-hmm. But they're selling everything all year round, and they didn't do that last year.
Right, right.
So, yeah, it's just, there's just, what about personal use of pesticides? Because that's also increasing.
That's right. And so, you know, now people want to have absolutely beautiful, green, lush lawns with no dandelions, no clover, no weeds. they don't recognize that these are important sources of pollen and nectar for honeybees, as well as many other solitary bee species that are involved in pollination of fruits, vegetables, and wild plants. And so they and them they that is part of the loss of forage for bees. Homeowners, as we heard earlier, can often use pesticides, including these neonicotinoids, at much higher rates than can growers, than agricultural growers, farmers. And so that is part of the problem as well. So there is the homeowner is part of this concern, the overuse of pesticides, including herbicides as well as insecticides.
And I would be willing to bet that some people might not know that they're using neonicotinoids. So can you name some very well-known pesticides that people might be using that are neonicotinoids?
So,
I mean, like on the bottle.
Maybe Scott, and
Bayer Advanced 3-in-1 Insect Disease and Mite Control. Bayer Advanced 12-month Tree and Shrub Insect Control. Bayer Advanced All-in-One Rose Flower Care Concentrate. DYI Tree Care Products Multi-Insect Killer. Green Light Grub Control with Arena. Things called Flagship and Meridian. And what's interesting, too, to point out is that most of these products have absolutely no warning labels on them. So you would not, one, know that unless you can look at that and say, oh, clothianidin, that is a neonicotinoid. I'm studied up on this. You have no idea, one, that these have these chemicals in them. And number two, on most of the labels, there's absolutely no warning that you should be careful about using these around certain fruits and vegetables and other crops that need pollination. Absolutely no warning labels.
How do you educate the public about this?
Well, one of the things Xerces does is we reach hundreds or thousands of people actually a year. We do talks. We do what are called our short courses on pollinator conservation. And through all of that, we're trying to educate folks on the potential impacts of all pesticide, insecticide use, and how if they need or feel they need to use these insecticides, how to use them in a way that is most protective for honeybees, native bees, as well as all of the other beneficial insects. So you just need to get out broadly to let people know of the situation. Shows like this are wonderful. We reach a lot of people, and people maybe start thinking, oh, is that what I'm spraying on my grass?
Right.
Is that what I'm keeping my roses beautiful with? People can go to the Xerces Society website at xerces.org and go to our pesticide section and find out a lot more information, as well as a table of what products are on the shelf and which ones have neonicotinoids. And in the scheme of things, though, I do want to reiterate back to what Marianne said. It's not just the neonicotinoids that are a problem. We need to be careful about spraying all of these different toxic chemicals, both around our animals, around our kids, and because of bees. And the more people can educate themselves about this, and the more people, you know, in yards, I think Marianne said it best, you don't need a perfect yard. You can squish the aphids on your roses. You can spray them off with water. You can use soapy water. There are many, many ways in especially a small homeowner situation to get rid of quote-unquote pests or at least to keep them at bay without using these really nasty insecticides.
And that is Scott Black, Executive Director of the Xerces Society. You can find a link at yourcallradio.org. Marianne Fraser, Senior Extension Associate at Penn State, and Paul Towers is Organizing and Media Director at the Pesticide Action Network. We have just about 5 minutes left, so if you'd like to weigh in, if you have a question, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. And before we get to our next call, Marianne, can you quickly talk about poor nutrition?
Yes, absolutely. So honeybees, as well as bumblebees and some other kinds of solitary bees, but for the most part, honeybees and bumblebees are generalist pollinators. They're polylectic, which means they need diverse sources of pollen in order to effectively rear their brood and to have viable colonies. And so that means they cannot, you know, survive on only almond pollen, for instance, or only apple pollen. And they are very good at seeking out these alternative sources of pollen, even when they're on a crop. The problem is, if they're in a place like Pennsylvania where the landscape is pretty diverse, even where we grow apples, they can do this pretty effectively. But in some places, like almonds, for instance, or almonds, as they say, that's hard to do. There's not alternative sources available. So while they're on a crop like that, they're at a nutritional disadvantage, if you will. And again, the widespread use of herbicides and the large monocultures are contributing to this lack of diversity of a forage available for pollinators. So it's one of the things that we definitely have, you know, on our radar as a major contributing factor to pollinator decline is lack of diverse sources of forage, lack of good food for the bees. And that, of course, you know, like any organism, when it's poorly nourished, it's more susceptible to things like diseases. Mm. And we know that mites and diseases are a part of the picture, and we think that lack of good nutrition as well as pesticides are contributing to their inadequate immune systems, which then we think also results in these diseases basically having a much larger impact on them than they might under normal circumstances. Mm.
Well, we've got a number of callers on the line. Our phones just lit up again, so let's take a few in a row, and then we'll get responses. Let's hear from Marie-Louise in Palo Alto. Hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. This has been a lot of very good information. And I have a very small sort of campaign, which I have been on for a number of years, and that is that whenever somebody says, oh, look at that, there's a whole bunch of wasps, watch out. And then I try to make people see the difference between a bee and a wasp, and that wasps are generally meat eaters, and bees are there, and they don't do you any harm unless you step on them, usually, for most people. I know there's some who are very allergic. But anyway, so that is one thing. And then beyond that, I also think we need to couple up what has happened to frogs, and also to point out, you know, with all of these pesticides, how strongly it affects birds.
Right.
You've mentioned this, but I think we need to point that out to people who don't really care about bees. Mm. And if we also say, you know, the frogs.
Yeah, there's so much more. Thank you. And I think they would care about bees if we explained how important they are. So thanks for calling in, Marie-Louise. Let's go next to Tom in Big Sur. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Hi, Rose. I just wanted to bring up the fact that we brought the European honeybee over here on our boats when we came over. And they weren't here before. And everywhere we went, they preceded us. They surrounded us and pollinated our crops. So they're a very valuable source that has been transplanted to America, like many other things, with diaspora and all. So I just wanted to bring up that fact that they preceded us. Everywhere we went, they were colonies of bees were ahead of us.
Mm. Yeah.
Moved on through the forest, the wilderness of West Virginia.
Yeah, that's a great point. Thank you so much, Tom. Let's go next to Esmeralda in San Francisco. Hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. When we teach our children about life, we teach them about, or we used to teach them about the birds and the bees. Children aren't taught the birds and the bees. It's like an old wives' tale. It's the story of how all life is perpetuated. And there isn't really one issue on any show you do, whether it's fracking, insecticides, breast cancer, fish eating plastic, that doesn't have to do with what everyone on your panel has said, that the system is broken because of the forces of death, frankly, which are the corporations and their attitude towards life and people's attitude towards insects. They wouldn't kill kittens, but everyone kills bugs without any sense of what they're for. Like, they get absolutely no respect whatsoever. And I really think it's truly a mythic battle between life and death.
Well, thank you. And hopefully that is all changing. Thanks for all the phone calls. We've got about a minute and a half left. So let's get final thoughts from all of you. We just found a story out of Boston in Boston Magazine called Beetown, Endangered Nationally. Honeybees are thriving in Boston. And they point to the city's plethora of gardens and parks, their limited use of pesticides, growing number of rooftop gardens, and apparently the bee population is really coming back there. So, you know, what are your thoughts on that, and where do you see this going, Paul?
Well, that's a really inspiring story to hear out of Boston. I've, you know, heard similar ones across California and the rest of the country. We know that if we can reverse this trend of lack of food and water, shelter, and the overuse of pesticides, we can create safe spaces. We call them honeybee havens across this country. And I think that's stories like what's happening in Boston and Santa Barbara. I've had some heard some recent stories, other parts of this country. If we can take those steps in our communities, we can hopefully help reverse this dramatic decline in bee populations. That's an important first step. It won't fix this broken system, as I think your caller just mentioned. And so what we all need to do, in addition to creating these honeybee havens, is let our political officials know that they need to restrict and help phase out the use of neonicotinoids and other pesticides and issues that pose problems for honeybees. And so we look to officials here in California that are beginning to consider some steps in that direction at the Department of Pesticide Regulation. Mm-hmm. And in the California Environmental Protection Agency. And hopefully some energy there will also help continue to spur that federal dialogue, because until now we've really seen a head-in-the-sand approach by the Environmental Protection Agency and the Department of Agriculture, and they're just not taking the issue seriously enough, and that's frightening.
Paul Towers is organizing and media director at the Pesticide Action Network. They recently sued the EPA over this issue. Scott Black is executive director of the Xerces Society. That's X-E-R-C-E-S. And Marianne Fraser is senior extension associate at Penn State. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. And thank you for your emails and phone calls. Sorry we didn't get to all of you. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. How should California schools be funded? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about California Governor Jerry Brown's plan to overhaul the state school funding system. His proposal redirects more money to schools with low income and English learning students. He calls the plan a civil rights cause for the children of California. So how are schools funded now? Which schools are inadequately funded? And is this the best way for the state to help economically disadvantaged school districts? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.